As the car sped on, over the streets and then into the countryside on a roughly paved road, Brun and Hazel struggled with the confined space in the back seat, each other, and the clothes they had to get off and put on. Brun, having more to take off, went first. Hazel helped her bind her breasts as flat as she could. Then Hazel and Brun tore a strip off the bottom of her dress to flatten Hazel as well. Getting into the long pants while trying to stay low, out of sight of passing ground cars, meant lying across the seat and each other. Hardest to put on were the boots, stiff leather on feet that had been bare for more than a year. It would all have been funny if they hadn't been so afraid of getting caught. Brun felt it had been worth it already. She had not laughed, really laughed, since her capture. And even though she could make no sound, the laughter eased her. Hazel tucked her hair up and jammed the hat on her head. Brun pushed her hat down on top of her head.
Hazel looks like a real person again.
Hazel sat leaning forward now, eyes sparkling with excitement, her face no longer obscured by hair. Her clothes fit a little loose, and the sleeves of her shirt were up the wrist a little, as if she had almost grown out of them. Hazel looked at Brun, smiling, and then lifted Brun's hat to push her hair more firmly under it. Brun felt that her own pants were bulky and too loose, but anything was better than that clinging skirt. Their driver glanced back.
Not likely to be seen out here. You do look different, I'll say that. Remember now, you have to walk like men, big steps, and look other men straight in the eye. Now, I'm going to let you off up here in about a mile, and then you'll have to hike over those hills. As soon as you're out of sight, you have to cut your hair real short, like no woman would, so you can take your hat off without being spotted as women. You take your hat off to women folk, even though they aren't supposed to look at you. It's polite. And men'll see you.
The map he gave them, along with a canteen and a packet of food, was supposed to guide them on the next stage. Brun looked at it and grinned in relief. Someone had marked it in standard measurements, not this planet's idiot miles. Someone had also printed, in a hand she thought she knew, "Brun, we're here." From the pull-off, a trail led up into the hills. A signpost had a string of names on it. Brun ignored them. After a few wavery strides, her legs remembered how to stretch, and she found her balance in the ridiculous boots. Hazel staggered once, grimaced, but moved up beside her. They were out of sight of the road in less than 100 meters, and into the thick scrub. Brun made scissor movements next to her head, and Hazel nodded. They slipped off the trail and into the head-high bushes to do some barbering. Brun made it clear with gestures that they must catch the hairs they cut off. She had no idea what to do with them, but they weren't going to leave them around as obvious trail markers. As her hair came off, as the wind reached her scalp, she felt her brain cooling, felt the lessons she'd been taught in the Fleet Escape and Evasion course coming back to her. She twisted the cut hanks of her own hair into a roll of the appropriate size, put it in one of the spare socks, and stuffed it down the front of her pants. Hazel goggled. Brun shrugged and swaggered a few steps.
We're men, we need men things.
Hazel had less hair for hers, but she was younger anyway, and it did make her look more like a boy. She struggled up the trail in those ridiculous boots. She'd have been more comfortable barefoot, but men didn't go barefoot.
Oh, stupid people. Only really stupid people would assign foot gear on the basis of gender rather than use. And choose these blistering boots for walking somewhere.
Hazel would have talked, but Brun waved her to silence. Voices carried in the open. Brun didn't know if she could do a boy's voice, and didn't want to find out she couldn't. So when they heard the men talking, she had a few seconds' warning. She caught Hazel's eye, jerked her chin up, and walked on. Around the next curve in the path came a pair of men, dressed much as she and Hazel were, though one of them had a bundle on his back. Brun stared straight at the first man, then the second, and tightened her lips. They gave her a short nod and strode by in silence. Brun felt herself start to shake and lengthened her stride. Hazel grabbed her arm and squeezed hard. Brun nodded. Neither looked behind as they struggled on up the hill. They had made it over the first ridge and halfway up the second when Brun's breasts began to throb. She glanced at the sky. Drat. The twins would be waking now, beginning to whimper, even if no one had found them before.
What?
Brunn put her hands to her breasts.
Swelling?
Brunn nodded. Minute by minute, they throbbed more until she felt she could not stand it. But her feet hurt almost as much.
Take your pick. At least you're out here.
She would walk her feet to bloody stubs and let her breasts explode before she would go back to that miserable nursery.
You miss your babies?
Brunn shook her head violently. Hazel looked shocked. Brunn regretted her vehemence, but she felt what she felt. If they had been someone else's babies, she might have felt a pang of softness for them. She had liked babies when someone else took care of them, but not these. She set her face resolutely to the trail and struggled on. Near sundown, they came to the clearing marked on Brunn's map. Here they were supposed to be met, or she was. Whoever it was wouldn't expect Hazel. The man who stepped out of the shadow of the trees not only didn't expect Hazel, he didn't want her.
I didn't get paid for two. What are you trying to pull, missy?
Brunn glared at him. Then she took the notebook from Hazel and wrote, "She goes too."
I wasn't paid.
Brunn made the universal signal for money and saw it recognized, proving once again that humans had a common origin, something she'd been willing to doubt this past year and more. She pointed to the sky, then rubbed her fingers again.
There's money there if you get us there.
All right. But I don't want to hear any complaints when it's crowded in the shuttle.
Shuttle here?
Brunn stared around. This was no shuttle field. But the man was walking quickly along the shadowed edge of the clearing, and she followed.
We got us a ways to go, and I guess it's lucky I brung an extra. Hope you can ride.
With that, he ducked into the trees, and Brunn smelled horses. This was not how she'd planned to ride again. She had imagined herself on one of her father's hunters, galloping over the fields of home. Instead, Brunn had to stretch her sore legs on the wide barrel of a brown horse with all the character of a sofa, because Hazel, who had never been on a horse before, had to have a saddle. The man swore he couldn't ride bareback, and if he was used to that armchair for a saddle, no wonder. At least her body had not forgotten that balance.
By God, you can ride!
As she moved up beside him, Brunn smiled, thinking non-smiling thoughts. He looked over at Hazel.
That's it.
Brunn glanced over. Hazel looked terrified. She was clutching the knob that stuck up from the front of the saddle as if it could anchor her, and trying to strangle the horse with her legs. Brunn caught her eye and gestured down her own body.
Sit straight. Head up. Relax your legs.
Hazel straightened. They rode through the night, meeting no one at all on the trail. Brunn shifted as one spot after another wore raw. She had wanted to wear pants again. She had wanted to ride again.
Be careful what you ask for.
When first light began to give shape to the treetops on the slopes above them, their guide slowed.
It's only a tad more. Just down this slope.
At the foot of the slope, they came out of trees and brush to find a long grassy field ending in a steep hill. Brunn could not see anything resembling a shuttle.
Is this a trap after all?
But the man led the way along the edge of the field, and she realized it might be a grass runway. It was longer than it looked. When she glanced back along it, the far end was hidden in ground fog. The hill, as they neared it, revealed a hangar door set into it.
That's promising.
Set back under the trees was a log cabin with a peaked roof. Beyond it was a larger log building, a barn, and in between was an enclosure of peeled poles where two more horses and a cow munched hay. The man led them up to a gate set into the enclosure and swung off his horse as if he'd only ridden an hour or so, not all night. Neither Brunn nor Hazel could dismount alone. The man had to help them, pushing and tugging.
Put your arm around me. Just get off. Get off the damn horse. Come on.
Brunn wished for the ability to swear back. She had not been on a horse in years, and in between, she'd borne twins.
What does he expect after riding all night bareback?
She was sure she'd worn all the skin off her thighs and buttocks. As for Hazel, she'd never ridden before. She'd be lucky if she could walk at all in a few hours. In the cabin, a stocky woman prepared breakfast for all of them. She never looked at them, never spoke, but set plates in front of them and kept them full. Brunn raged inwardly, but they could not take all the women on this planet.
I will come back. somehow.
After breakfast, Brunn managed to stand up. She gave Hazel a hand. Outside, the man was opening the hangar door, and at last Brunn could see what was waiting for them. Her grin broadened. It was a little mixed-purpose shuttle, the same kind she'd been in when Cecilia had sent her back to Rockhouse. She could fly it herself if she had to. She thought briefly of knocking the man on the head and doing just that, but she had no idea how he planned to evade traffic control, if this place even had traffic control. It did have warplanes, though, and she had no desire to meet them. With considerable difficulty, Brunn helped Hazel up the narrow ladder into the shuttle. The man was already busy at the controls. He glowered when Brunn made her way forward and settled herself in the other control seat.
Don't touch anything.
Brunn watched. Everything looked much the same as on Corey's ship. Although the names of the measures were strange, she could identify most of the instruments. The man ran down the same sort of checklist. The trees at the far end approached too rapidly. Brunn could remember going much faster than this at Rotterdam. Suddenly, the shuttle rose into the air as if hoisted on a crane.
Short field ability. Surprised you, didn't I? She needs a third less runway, and she can clear 100 feet when she goes up.
Sun streamed in the cockpit windows. Brunn stared avidly at the control panel. Her mind had been so hungry all this time for something real, something to do. She glanced back at Hazel. The girl grinned, pointing to the gauges. Yes, a spacer girl. She would have had the same hunger. But now Hazel was looking out and down at the shadowy folds of hills and valleys receding as they rose. Was this perhaps her first planet? Brunn had never thought of that. Higher, there was a river winding between hills with a roll of ground fog like wool resting on the hill to windward. The craft climbed steeply and the view widened every minute. Over there should be the city they came from with its spaceport. Yes. Smaller than she expected, though the spaceport had landing space enough for a dozen shuttles. Higher, higher. The morning sky that had been a soft, bright blue darkened again. The gauge that must be an altimeter had reeled off thousands and ten thousands, but Brunn didn't know what the unit of measure was. It neared 60,000-somethings and passed it. Then the pilot pulled the nose up even higher and pushed a button on the left side of the cockpit. Acceleration slammed her back in her seat. The sky darkened quickly to black. Stars appeared. The pilot pointed through the front window. Brunn peered back and forth, not seeing what he meant, until Hazel tapped her arm.
10 o'clock, -30. Their space station.
Then she could see it, as its shape passed over a sparkling expanse of white cloud on the bulging planet below. She had been there on the inside, unable to see. And now she was here, free. Or almost free. The man handed Brunn a headset. She put it on.
Change it from lift engines to in system. We're supposed to rendezvous with something out here. Don't know if it's military or civilian or what. They gave me code words to use.
The craft lurched as he switched from one drive to another. Then the artificial gravity kicked in, and she might as well have been sitting in a model shuttle on some planet's surface. She glanced back at Hazel, who was grinning from ear to ear. It felt right to her as well, then. She peered out at the stars, burning steadily, but she could not recognize any of the geometry.
What system is this?
Might as well take a nap now she's on auto.
He switched off the banks of instruments, useless with this drive, and hung his headset on a hook.
Well, I'm gonna.
He closed his eyes and slumped in his seat. Brunn slid her headset down around her neck, but did not follow his example. Too much was at stake.
Oh, I'm really tired. And my legs.
Brunn mimed sleep at her and watched as Hazel dozed off. The man's snores were of such complexity that she was sure he couldn't have faked them. Brunn put out her hand to the controls, and he didn't stir. So here she was, on her way. She touched her knives, reminding herself that she was not going to be recaptured if anything went wrong. And out there somewhere, Fleet waited. She was sure it would be Fleet. Her father would not have risked anything less in taking on a whole planet. She hoped it wasn't far out, and she hoped very much that whatever ships were there didn't did not include one Lieutenant Esme Suiza. She was not ready to face that on top of everything else. An hour passed, and another. Despite herself, she yawned. She would have taken a stimulant if she'd had one. Another yawn. Her eyes sagged shut, and she struggled to open them, only to yawn again. She looked at her shipmates. The man was still asleep. Hazel slept neatly as a cat, curled into herself on the bench seat. Brunn tried pinching herself, changing positions, taking deep breaths. But in that steady, warm stillness, she slept in spite of herself. Brunn woke abruptly, with the feeling that something was very wrong. They were in freefall, but they had been on in-system drive with the artificial gravity on. The pilot was awake and changing switch positions on the main board. Brunn looked at Hazel, who was also awake, hanging upside down above the bench where she'd slept. She reached back, tapped her arm, and nodded toward the pilot.
What are we doing?
End of the line, girlies. I've been talking to them over there.
He gestured, and Brunn looked out to see a dark shape against the starfield. What it really was, or how far away, she couldn't tell, but she could see the ovoid shape of a warship.
Fleet?
I get more from them for turning you in than from you for taking you on. An abomination is one thing. I didn't bargain on a runaway from Ranger Bowie's house.
Not Fleet.
Brunn's stomach tightened. The pilot smirked at them and opened his mouth to speak into the headset. Brunn uncoiled from her seat, twisting in midair, and slammed both booted feet into the side of his head. Hazel pushed off the overhead to get her forearm around the man's neck and hold it against the tall seat back, while Brunn untangled herself from the cords and wires her attack had landed her in.
What do I do if he gets the...
The man jerked against her arm and then grabbed her arm and tried to free himself. But he was strapped in, and Brunn already had her knife out and a firm hold on the back of his seat for leverage. She jammed the knife under his ribs and up, just as she had been told. He twisted, struggling for a moment longer, then slumped. That long, elephant-skinning knife had the length to reach his heart. Brunn stared at Hazel, who was white with shock. But they had no time for shock. Catching her feet under the co-pilot's seat, she unhooked the pilot's harness and started pulling his body out of the seat, pushing it to the back. Drops of blood followed it, floating, dispersing.
Can you pilot?
Brunn grinned and nodded, then clambered into the seat. Hazel climbed over the pilot, still twitching a little but beyond help, and made it into the co-pilot's seat, strapping herself in quickly.
In-system drive. Where is the in-system drive?
And she didn't want to run them right into that warship. She gestured to Hazel. Rotate us. Point us that way. Parallel to the warship's axis, toward what she hoped was its stern. Hazel touched the controls, and the stars wheeled crazily. Brunn ignored that, and her ears, and found the inset black square that should be the in-system drive startup. She pushed it. Nothing happened.
What else? Oh, yes. Safety release.
She tried again, in sequence.
Release. Startup. Drive on.
The sudden apparent lurch of the dust in the cockpit told her they were under drive again.
Now for the AG. Down there. 1/10.
And the dust settled, leaving the cockpit clearer. Behind her, the pilot's body fell to the deck. A little red globule slid past her gaze and attached itself to her shirt. Blood. The pilot's blood. And she'd never thought about what would happen if she cut his throat in zero-G. They could be drowning in the stuff, unable to see any of the controls. Maybe her luck was back, but she wouldn't count on it. She notched up the in-system drive. If she had the pilot figured right, he was a smuggler or something, and his personal shuttle would be overpowered, up to and maybe beyond the structural limits of the craft. She found the accelerometer and the V-scale, but the blasted thing was in MPH, whatever that was, rather than meters per second. Still, it was fast, and going faster. Hazel touched her arm. She had found the scan controls. Two screens came up, system-wide and local.
Local's the problem.
The warship behind them was lighted up like a Christmas tree with active weapons scans. But according to Esme, anything as small as a shuttle was hard to hit, if it was far enough away. Well, the answer to that was to get far enough away, and that meant speed. She notched the drive up again. The little craft still felt stable as a rock. Corey's had gone faster. She notched it up again and again. Hazel tapped her arm. On the system scan, several ships were flagged with weapons markers, and behind, the warship had swapped ends and was in pursuit. It had always been a small chance. She'd known that. Better to die out here than back there. She hoped Hazel felt that way. She cocked her head at the girl.
It'll be close. But I like it.
Well, close or not, that's the right attitude.
Brunn pointed at the drive controls and mimed shoving it to the line. Hazel looked at the scan and nodded.
What the hell? It can't be worse.
Brunn rammed the control all the way to the end of the slot. The shuttle vibrated down its length. And behind them on the scan, an explosion marred the pattern.
If I hadn't accelerated...
We could jump, couldn't we? These shuttles are jump capable.
We could jump, but where?
Supposedly, there was a fleet ship in system waiting to pick them up, if she could find it. Another explosion. The little ship shivered as fragments impacted its minimal shields. Hazel pointed.
Another one!
Brunn glanced at the scan and saw another weapons-lighted warship. They weren't going to make it through this. She might as well jump and sort it out later if she could. She found the jump controls and started the checklist. Never leave out the checks, Oblo had told her, because you can get killed just as dead by a malfunction as by an enemy. Her hands raced over the controls, but she left nothing out. When she was ready, she tapped Hazel on the shoulder and pointed to the jump initiation control. Hazel nodded, and Brunn pushed it. Nothing happened. Brunn pushed it again. Some of these controls stiffened if not used regularly. Hazel nudged Brunn and pointed.
It's asking for a validation code.
On a side panel, a small display had lit, and the words, voice recognition validation required prior to jump insertion. The one thing they couldn't do was produce an approximation of the pilot's voice, and whatever code words he'd used. She slammed her fist once more against the useless button and turned her attention to what they could do. The system was woefully short of useful pieces of rock, at least near the planet. No moons to land on. She would have given a lot for a moonlet with caves to hide in. So, make use of the terrain you've got, her instructors had said. No terrain in space, though. If she could get back to the planet, they could hide out in the wilderness. Or they could be recaptured as they tried to land. That was worse than death. She'd dive this thing into the ground before she let that happen. She glanced at Hazel. The girl was pale-faced, but calm, waiting for Brunn to do something.
Terrain.
It all came back to escape and evasion. And in space, that meant outrun or hide out. They couldn't outrun the warships, and there wasn't any place to hide.
Except, what if we went straight for the Elias Madero, docked at the space station? Could we get inside? Hide in it?
It would take a long time to find them, time in which fleet might be coming. Or might not. She looked around the cockpit. Somewhere, the pilot must have had local space charts. They had not run into any of the things which must be up here, the various satellites and stations. She didn't spot charts, but she did spot a noteboard. She scribbled local charts on it and handed it to Hazel.
We're not going back, are we?
Not exactly. Hide.
Hazel seemed to understand the mouthed words and nodded. Backed off from its maximum velocity, the little ship could maneuver surprisingly well. Brunn kept an eye on the scans as she jinked back and forth, counting to herself in a random sequence she'd once memorized for the pleasure of it. Her other eye was on the fuel gauge. Rapid maneuvering ate up fuel at an alarming rate.
Local nav charts up on the screen.
Brunn spared a glance. Little satellites, big satellites, space stations. She hadn't realized this place had more than one station, and a large number of uncategorized items. Most were drifting in a more or less equatorial orbit, though a few were in polar orbits. In size, these ranged from bits as small as pencils to stations a kilometer across. She needed something big enough. An orbital station would be perfect, but of course there wouldn't be one. Hazel leaned past her and tapped something. Brunn glanced again. Something long and skinny, much bigger than the shuttle, and marked on the chart with a large red X.
Well, whatever it is, it will have to do.
Brunn nodded at Hazel and pointed to the nav computer. She couldn't figure a course to it in her head, not in dodge hostile fire. In a moment or two, the course came up on the nav screen, along with an estimate of fuel consumption. Very close. You'd have to spend fuel to dump V and spiral around the planet on a much longer approach than Brunn really wanted, with ships shooting at her. And if she was really lucky, maybe the two enemy ships would run into each other and remove that problem. Minute by minute, as the shuttle curved back toward the planet, Brunn expected the bright flash that would be the last thing she ever saw. Behind, to either side, but none of them as close as they had been.
The boost out took hours. How long will it take to get back using all the power I can? How much of the outbound trip was unpowered? How long did I sleep before waking to zero G?
Brunn didn't know. She didn't have time to think about it. Only time to watch the scans and the nav screen and do what she could to conserve their fuel.
One's out!
Brunn nodded. One of their pursuers had miscalculated a boost and was now out of sight behind the planet. The other, farther away, was probably out of missile range. At least, nothing had blown up anywhere near them for some time. The other red-marked icons she could see were farther away and didn't appear to be chasing her. Yet. She could have used Kutsudis's enhanced scan. She didn't even know what size those things were. Even ordinary fleet scan would have told her that and located any fleet ships in system as well.
We might actually make it.
She glanced at the fuel gauge again. Enough to decelerate to match their target. And that small margin which would give her a chance to try a last wild gamble. She linked the autopilot to the nav computer for the approach, trusting the universe enough to take this moment to stretch before trying to dock to an uninhabited derelict. The little shuttle lay snugged to the station, hidden from several directions by the sheltering wing of the station. Brunn hoped its thermal signature would be hidden as well, but she didn't trust it. They might be detected from the ground as well as space. She looked around. The dead pilot nuzzled the stained plastic of the bulkhead, held there by one of the ventilation drafts. They needed pressure suits. While she wasn't actually naked, she felt the hungry vacuum outside. Her clothes were no protection. They needed to get off the shuttle and onto something bigger with more air.
We need a miracle.
Brunn spotted what might be a pea suit locker and aimed Hazel at it. Sure enough, inside was a smudged yellow pea suit, easily large enough for either of them. One pea suit, not two. Hazel clearly knew how to check out a suit. She was running the little nozzle of the tester down each seam. Brunn waited until Hazel had checked it all, including the air tanks.
It's fine. Both tanks full? That's 6 hours, if I understand their notation.
6 hours for one person. Could Fleet get from where it was to here in 6 hours? Not likely. The shuttle's air supply was much bigger. They would have air for 4 or 5 days. But if the warships found the shuttle, they would be dead before then.
Priority one, find another pea suit. Priority two, find air.
Weapons would be nice.
She seems so docile, so sweet. Is she really thinking?
From her face, she was. With the helmet on, Hazel tested her comm circuit. They would use it, they decided, only to tell Brunn she was on her way back. No need to let everyone on the planet know where they were if they hadn't been spotted. With Hazel gone, Brunn took the opportunity to search the dead pilot. Like all the men, he had packed a small arsenal, a knife at his belt, another in his boot, and a third up his sleeve, as well as a slug thrower capable of putting a hole in the hull.
What did he want with that aboard a ship?
A needler in the other boot and two small beamers, one up the other sleeve and one tucked into the back of his belt.
Bringing suits? Problems.
Suits? Why suits plural? Damn that girl. Why couldn't she say more? Or nothing?
Soon enough, sooner than Brunn expected, Hazel cycled through. An empty pea suit came out first, scattering glittering dust from its turquoise skin.
Turquoise?
Brunn rolled it over, and there on the back was a label, Blue Sky Bio Designs, and a code number whose meaning she could not guess. Hazel, next, in the pilot's dirty yellow pea suit, towing another turquoise model. Then two spare breathing tanks lashed to the second pea suit. When they cleared the hatch, Brunn reached behind her to dog the interlock seal as Hazel popped her helmet seal.
Brunn, it's really strange in there. I found a suit locker right away, but the tank locker beside it was empty. So I had to hunt around, and I've never seen a station like it.
Brunn tapped her shoulder and wrote, Laboratory, Genetic Engineering.
Oh, well, that might explain the broken stuff then, but listen. Brunn, the oddest thing. Remember how this pea suit's fitted for males? All the suits in the station lockers, the ones I looked in anyway, are fitted for females. That's why I brought two. It's a lot more comfortable. And near as I can tell, these suits have all the functions we need. And I found women's clothes scattered around. Soft ship suits. Better than these rough things. If your legs are as sore as mine.
Hazel was right. Already, Hazel was unsuiting, packing the pilot's pea suit away with practiced skill as she came out of it, hardly swaying as she steadied herself with first one hand, then the other. Brunn opened the first turquoise suit and found the clothes. Soft, fleecy pants and tops in colors she hadn't seen for far too long. Bright, clear, artificial colors. Hazel had brought an assortment, bless her. Different sizes and colors.
You're so much taller. I hope what I got is big enough.
Brunn nodded. She watched Hazel try to wriggle out of her clothes, wincing, and struggle into the softer ones. Brunn had found a pair of black pants that seemed longer than the rest, and a cream-colored shirt that was bigger around. Even bound, her milk-swollen breasts had added to her size.
Should we use the shuttle's waste can before we suit up?
Brunn shook her head. They would need every recycled bit of air and water. She started trying to shuck her own pants and realized that she was simply too stiff. It hurt too much. Hazel moved to help her. Brunn held one of the grab-ons and gritted her teeth as Hazel started to pull the stiff pants down.
Is this the pilot's blood or yours?
Brunn shook her head, shrugged, and then nodded. It made no difference. The pants had to come off. Hazel worked them free.
You're raw. From the riding, I hope. I didn't know it was so much worse without a saddle or I'd have switched off with you.
She couldn't have done it, but Brunn appreciated the offer.
We have to put something on this.
The chill air bit into the raw places, and Brunn shuddered at the thought of anything touching her.
I'll look.
Brunn kept her eyes shut and tried to steady her breathing.
It isn't as bad as being raped. It isn't as bad as being pregnant. It isn't as bad as childbirth. I survived all that. This is just an inconvenience.
She opened her eyes and smiled at Hazel, who was watching her with a worried look.
I found a med kit and put it in the other pea suit. One of those emergency kits they always put near suit lockers.
Brunn nodded and freed a hand to wave a go-ahead signal. The bite of the pain-killing spray would have gotten a yelp from her if she'd had the voice to yelp with, but the almost instant cessation of pain was amazing. She'd forgotten how fast good meds worked. Hazel followed that with a spray of antibiotic and skin sealant. Brunn unpeeled her hands from the grab-on and was able to snag the soft black pants she'd chosen and put them on herself. Then into the pea suits, where the plumbing fixtures connected as they ought, and all the gauges and readouts worked. Brunn sniffed the air coming from the nose filters. Nothing she could smell, and the ship's suit check said it was safe. They filled the suit's water tanks from the shuttle tanks. Brunn folded an extra set of ship suits into padding for the back of her pea suit, and Hazel followed her example. They packed up all the food they could find in the shuttle and stuffed the pea suit's external storage. All this had taken longer than Brunn hoped, but according to the shuttle scans, no active scan had pinged them yet. Now she finished setting up the autopilot for what she hoped would be an effective screening action. Ideally, they would have been able to tie into the shuttle scans from within the space station and send it off under remote control, but Brunn had long since given up waiting for ideal conditions. She would send it off on a time delay, giving them time to get well into the station. Hazel had left the outer lock open, with an air tank lashed in the gap just in case some officious bit of old programming was still operating and tried to shut it, so they didn't have to worry about entrance. With the little fuel left aboard, she couldn't set up a very complicated course, and she had to assume that ground-based radars had plotted their whereabouts anyway. Probably one of the warships was even now maneuvering in an attempt to recapture them. For maximum acceleration, Brunn decided to run the takeoff and in-system drives together, something no experienced pilot would do, but it was the only way to get the ship well away in a hurry. When she was done, she nodded at Hazel, and they both sealed up. They had made their plans. They had said all they had to say until they were in the station. They crammed into the tiny airlock and cycled out. Outside was a confusion of highlight and black shadow. Brunn followed Hazel along the length of the shuttle's hull to the station's wing. From here, she could see that there was a shuttle docking bay. If she'd known that, they could have been safe inside hours ago, because it looked as if it had passenger tubes still deployed. No time for that now. Hazel led her from one grab-on to another toward the emergency lock portal. They were almost to the portal when the grab-on she held bounced in her hand, then vibrated strongly. Brunn looked back. The shuttle's dual drive had come alive, and the little ship slid away from the station, its takeoff reaction engine exhaust glowing against the dark. It moved faster, faster, out into the sunlight, where it glittered like a bright needle.
Will they believe it?
The course she'd plotted would have been hazardous for an experienced pilot, requiring extreme maneuvers to reverse burn and survive atmospheric re-entry. But it was the most direct way to the ground, if you didn't mind burning up along the way. They had no women pilots. Even with what they knew of her background, they might think, she hoped they would think, that she was a panicky female who didn't understand orbital mechanics, who was running directly for cover. She hadn't grown up hunting foxes for nothing. She looked around again, trying to spot any of the warships. There, possibly, a dark shape blotting out part of the starfield. And there, below them, the more pointed shape of another shuttle against the cloud field on the planet below. She felt her lips stretching in a grin that had no humor in it.
Coming to catch me, are they? They'll get a surprise.
Sneaking a task force into a system with a single mapped jump point had taken considerable tricky navigation, especially since they knew few details of the defensive layout. Esme, as Shrike's executive officer, had checked and double-checked every one of the short FTL hops that had brought them into the system via the jump point in another nearby. Nearby in stellar terms. But it had been a difficult period. Some of the jumps had required flux levels well above those recommended. Once in the system, micro-jumps with low relative V insertion had hopped them in, apparently without detection, until they were positioned to observe the escape. For days now, they had hung, unnoticed, well above the ecliptic, monitoring all transmissions from the planet. Far out, the rest of the task force waited in case of need, trading hours of scan lag for obscurity. Shrike had acquired several specialist crew, who, according to Admiral Serrano, would enhance their chances if anything went wrong. This included Kutsudis at scan, and warrant officers Oblo Vesicuan and Methlin Mahari, all three of whom had worked with Brun before. Esme, watching Kutsudis' enhanced scan at work, helped map everything it picked up. At present, the enemy warships in system included four lightweights in classic tetragonal array around the planet, about half a light second out, and another lightweight docked at the orbital station. Of the lightweights, three were escort size and two patrol size. 3 light minutes out, something that massed like a half-sized cruiser seemed to represent the enemy's idea of a forward defensive force. All these had their weapon systems live, a careless convenience that made it easy for Kutsudis to analyze them. Word on the extraction had been mixed. The Guarnesi agent in place had sent off a signal at the agreed frequency, but with cows instead of cow, and mention of a price increase. The plan had not included bringing the babies. What could the plural mean? Had there been another woman with Brun? That could be disastrous. Pursuit might follow more quickly, or the other woman might resist. Esme wondered if the second person could be the older girl from the Merchanter. Kutsudis, listening in on transmissions, picked up something about Ranger Bowie's patience having disappeared, and more about a search underway for the Abomination.
They know she's gone. I hope she got clean away.
That's probably why Ranger Bowie's patience is gone. He captured her.
Maybe.
When Kutsudis acquired the shuttle signal hours later, the tension increased again. Esme felt she could hardly breathe. Now, on the scan screens, the bright dot moved out and out, coming ever nearer. If the plan worked perfectly, in a day or so they would rendezvous with the little craft, take Brun aboard, and jump out system before the enemy realized they had been there. Then, with Brun safe, the rest of the task force would have time to blockade the planet and start negotiating the return of the other prisoners. If the plan didn't work, a cascade of contingency plans devolved from any point of discovery.
Go get some food, people. It's going to be a long wait. Sweeza, that means you too. Go eat, then sleep. Be back in 4 hours.
Esme tore herself away from the screens and found she could actually down a full meal. She had skipped a couple without even noticing. She knew she should sleep, but she lay on her bunk, not sleeping, thinking of Baron over on Jurfalcon, of Lord Thornbuckle back at Sector, of the remarkable Professor Meyerson. The alarm woke her, and she rolled off her bunk, smoothed her hair, much easier these days, and headed for the bridge. There, she found a grim mood, unlike that earlier. Kutsudis bent over the scan.
That son of a bitch has sold him out. He's cut out the in-system drive, put him on a zero-G ballistic for that militia ship.
The enemy ships were still holding their tetragonal formation.
What are our options?
We can micro-jump between them and the warship, but the backwash might get him. Stuff I'm getting is a minute old. We aren't sure where they are.
It's worth a try.
Kutsudis held up a hand.
Wait! Hot damn, she wasn't fooled.
What's
there? I can't get focus on the cabin good enough, but there's something going on. What? There's three people in there, not two.
Rotation!
Kutsudis glanced at his screen.
You're right, Atten. Let's see.
But they all saw that the shuttle's icon had come alight with the cone that meant acceleration. The cone lengthened, then lengthened again, vectoring away from the planet past the warship.
Gotta be Brunn. She's remembered to run past him. Come on, girl, knock it to the wall.
Moment by moment, the cone lengthened. An arrow angled away from the planet, toward the distant freedom of deep space. But the little ship was deep in the gravity well, and the warship had the high ground.
Weapons discharge!
The shuttle was still in easy missile range of the warship. But just before the plotted course intersected, the cone lengthened again.
That girl's born to win. She sucked that out of him like a pro. Of course, their systems are optimized to hit big, slow things. Notice it didn't blow where it should have. They didn't change the arming options. I hope she figures that out. They'd have to be lucky.
Another enemy ship on the chase! Intersecting, more weapons discharges!
The second ship, one of the patrol class, had left its station on the tetragonal array and boosted to intercept.
Come on, girl, do something!
The cone shifted shape, its tip changing direction, the colors fragmenting and reforming.
Damn it, not that!
She's trying to dodge! She can't make it that way. It gives them time to get into position.
It might work, if they don't think to reset their targeting options, if they don't get a lucky hit. But she'd do better to run this way if she knew we were here.
Esme watched the displays, her heart pounding. She could imagine herself in Brunn's place. Every move Brunn made was one she would have made, again and again.
She's heading back. Is she gonna try to land on the planet?
No. She's heading for the orbital stuff.
You think so? Well, what makes you think that, Lieutenant?
It's her style. She'd have tried to jump, and something prevented her. That ship should have jump engines, but maybe they're not working. Failing that, a straight run would make her an easy target, so she dodged about. But that uses fuel, so she's looking for cover.
It's a lot of thinking for someone just hauled out of prison.
She wouldn't panic. She's smart, brave, and a risk-taker.
That's the truth. She's in real trouble here. Unless she's planning to toss herself out the door in a pea suit and hope they shoot the shuttle down. And there's still two live ones in the shuttle. She brought someone with her.
If they have multiple pea suits, she'll probably try that. But given what we know about these people, I doubt there are pea suits for all of them aboard. We should micro-jump in closer.
And tell their system we're here? Before the rest of the task force comes in? I thought you were the one who said one woman wasn't worth a war.
When there was a chance to get her out without one, no. In present circumstances, when a covert extrication has gone sour, it's the only way to get close enough to do her any good.
Captain Solis gave her a long look.
You would risk the entire operation?
Micro-jump to within 15 seconds, Scandalay, yes, sir, I would. Give them something else to think about. They know she was intended to meet something. They don't know what.
They don't know for sure it was in the system.
If the pilot turned, he'd have told them everything up to the recognition codes. They know someone's waiting for her. We might as well show something. Any delay can help her. And we can maneuver sufficiently for the integrity of the ship.
Sweeza, that sounds a lot more like the hero of Xavier.
He turned to the communications officer.
Give me a tight beam and load a compressed summary of scan. We'll also drop a beacon. 30 seconds to jump, people.
Shrike popped out of its micro-jump at low relative system velocity, and the scans cleared.
Total blackout, 2 minutes 45 seconds.
Scan lit with the shuttle's beacon and the others. Three escort-size warships, two patrol-size, something that masked like a half-size cruiser, and a clutter of small craft. All blazed with live weapons warning icons.
They'll acquire us in a second or so, and we should be picking up active scan signals shortly. There.
The warship's icons all showed acceleration cones. Those already under boost had the skewed cones of ships changing direction. The skewed cones lengthened as those ships pulled away from their pursuit to redirect their attention to the newcomer.
Looks like we're sucking them off the shuttle.
The shuttle's position had moved. It was clear now that it was running back toward the planet, with rapid changes of acceleration to make it a difficult target. The screens blinked as the SAR kinked in a tiny micro-jump, then cleared again. The enemy icons responded more slowly this time. Good. anything to confuse them, distract them. Another jink, to within a half second, and then another. A distant explosion, where one of the enemy had released a missile at more than maximum range to detonate uselessly. It was low enough now to be in the orbital trash. It disappeared around the far side of the planet from them. Long minutes passed while they waited, jinking in random sequence micro-jumps to keep the enemy guessing. If Brunn had slowed enough, it would be another hour and a half before the icon reappeared. Too soon, they saw it again, now moving rapidly in a suicidal dive for the surface.
They'll burn up on the first pass going like that. What the hell is that girl thinking of? Did she lose control of the ship?
Maybe she doesn't have enough fuel for a proper descent. Maybe she'd rather burn...
Esme could feel her heart pounding. She knew without question what Brunn had done.
She's not in the ship.
What, do you think it's flying itself? You're the one who said they probably didn't have pea suits. They couldn't have spaced themselves.
Unless they found something with pea suits. Or an air supply. If they did, I can see Brunn sending the shuttle off as a decoy.
The only active station, the only thing up here with air and pea suits, is the main station where Elias Madero is docked. I can guarantee they didn't dock there. Leaving aside the fact that if they did, they'd have been captured because it's occupied.
Uh-oh.
They turned. The militia ships had not waited to see if the shuttle would burn. From safely outside the danger zone, they'd sent missiles in pursuit, and a dying flare of the screen showed that they'd hit it.
Well, that's that. Barring Lieutenant Suiza's unlikely suggestion that there are two pea suits now floating somewhere in orbit, they're dead. No one survives a direct hit on a shuttle.
Esme had been flipping through Kutsudis' scan catalog of the orbiting trash.
Here's something, and it's consistent with the origin of that burn.
Kutsudis glanced at it quickly.
It's derelict. There's an old reactor at the core, but the rest of it's at ambient temp.
It's big enough. The shuttle course tracks back.
Kutsudis pulled up an enlarged version of the thumbnail in the catalog.
Look, it's big, but it's a wreck. Even from here, you can see the whole sections are open to vacuum.
Esme blinked. Open to vacuum they were, but... She remembered the special materials fabrication unit, open just like this.
Could it have been a vacuum processing or manufacturing facility?
They don't have anything like that. They buy or steal their space-made products.
They do now. Didn't the Guarnesi ambassador mention a facility that used to be here? From before the militia took over this planet?
The operative word is derelict, Lieutenant. Even if Brunn and her companion made it there, it won't do them any good. No air, no food, no effective shields, no weapons.
It might have had pea suits, sir. Even if it was ransacked by the militia, they might not have taken everything. I think she's there, and I think we should go get her.
I think you're trying to redeem your career, Lieutenant, at the cost of other people's lives.
Sir, the captain has a right to whatever opinion of me the captain holds. But that woman, those women, have one chance only for survival, and that's someone on our side getting to them with air and protection before either their air runs out or the bad guys figure out that the shuttle was a decoy. If the captain thinks I'm a conniving glory hound, there are others on the ship who can do the rescue. But it needs to be done.
Solis gave Esme a long look, which she met squarely.
You would volunteer for such a mission?
Yes, sir.
Who should go, do you think?
A full SAR team, sir. Even though we know of only two personnel who may have medical problems, we should anticipate that the militia may send a boarding party. Have figured Brunn's thinking just as I have. We may be fighting. We will, at the very least, be doing a rescue under hostile conditions.
Solis looked around the bridge, and his gaze came to rest on Kutsudis.
You've worked with Brunn, Meager.
Yes, sir.
What do you think?
Sir, I think Lieutenant Suiza is right about how Brunn thinks. She's very quick, very ingenious, and willing to take risks. If she did dock to any of the junk we found orbiting this planet, that derelict station is the obvious place. If she's not dead, then that's where she'll be. Suiza is also right that if she did dock there, it would have been detected by any decent ground-based sensing system. We can't assume that they don't have one. If I were the militia, I'd have shuttles on the way, and in fact, we've spotted shuttle takeoffs, three altogether.
Solis looked past Esme.
Meharry, you're also specially assigned to this mission. What's your assessment?
Lieutenant's on target, Captain. And the longer we sit around here jawing about it, the worse off Brunn's gonna be.
Would you trust Lieutenant Suiza on a mission like this? Or is she grandstanding?
With me along? Sure, Captain. Personally, I think she's straight. But if I'm there, she won't have a chance to screw up.
Lord Thornbuckle has insisted all along that Sarah Meager would not want to see Lieutenant Suiza.
I think Brunn would be glad to see anyone on our side. And from what I saw at Xavier and heard from people on Kos, the Lieutenant is ideally suited to this sort of thing.
That could be taken more than one way, but Esme wasn't feeling picky.
Very well. Lieutenant, you'll take Team 1 and warn Officers Meharry and Vasishuan.
Esme did not need to be told that they would be watching her as much as helping Brunn. Freed at last to do what she knew she was best at, Esme felt her spirits rising. Their mission was beyond difficult, but so had others been. Brunn might not be on the derelict, or if she was, she might already have died from any of a thousand things. If they found her, they might find a corpse, or they might all be blown up by a militia missile, aimed or stray. None of that mattered now. Clear in her mind was the plan, as if someone had drawn it in scarlet ink on white paper. She heard herself explaining it in crisp phrases to the others, and they responded to her confidence, her enthusiasm. By the time she was in the pinnace, her pea suit on but not sealed, and the gloves flipped back, the first flurry of action had settled to a purposeful, organized bustle.
Lieutenant, you were right about two things. Kutsuda says he's picked up a single signal from the derelict, something he believes only Sarah Meager would send. Fleet frequencies, fleet codes, and a message that the Fox has gone to ground. And there's at least one shuttle headed for the derelict. We can't get you there before it arrives. Our jump limit will leave you at least 5 minutes behind them.
Yes, sir.
The rest of the Wave's in system, and I've been in contact with the Admiral. I'm sending both SAR teams, and the other pinnace will have all the supplies we can stuff into it. You have discretion to use whatever force is necessary to protect Sarah Meager and her companion. We will be sending reinforcements when we've dealt with the other ships, but that may be some hours. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Hours. It might be days before they were reinforced. And they would have no heavy weapons. The sonic riot control generators used in aired-up stations wouldn't work on a derelict open to vacuum.
Meharry.
Meharry's eyes had a feral glitter reflecting Esme's own enthusiasm.
Yes, sir.
Captain tells me we're going to be docking 5 minutes behind a hostile shuttle. The station's supposedly not aired up. At least some of it isn't aired up. We'll need more than small arms.
I'm on it.
Meharry ducked out, leaving Esme staring at blank air. Well, she'd been with Harris Serrano for years, and this was how it was supposed to work. Tell the good ones what to accomplish and then get out of their way. But she hadn't expected to feel quite this...
Lieutenant!
It was a squad of neuro-enhanced troops, heavily laden with weapons segments.
We'll be first out as usual.
Right, and with hostiles ahead of us. And no idea whether our rescue targets have pressure suits.
Piece of cake. None of the hostiles are going to be female, from what I hear, and our targets are. So we just shoot the bad boys and leave the girls alone.
What now?
Brunn shrugged. She needed to think. She was hungry, thirsty. She sipped at the helmet tube. And very, very sleepy. And her legs hurt. The anesthetic spray was wearing off.
What can we do with the few weapons we have?
Brunn remembered the training from Escape and Evasion. Your best weapon is between your ears. Yes, and she'd like to keep it there, preferably in one piece.
If we could get the artificial gravity on, then we could turn it off.
Brunn supposed she meant in order to confuse their enemies, but it would gain them only minutes, if that. It would certainly reveal their presence. The gravity generator wouldn't be on if no one was here. A vague plan began to form in her brain, shapeless as rising mist. Exploring the controls while in a pea suit was a lot safer than playing around with them otherwise. Brunn grinned as she remembered Oblo's cautionary tales. She prodded one after another, seeing what worked.
Lights!
That was obvious.
But is it lights in this room, or overall?
Brunn waved a wide-armed gesture. Hazel nodded and pushed off to explore. Brunn peered at the panel. If she could figure out how to bring up station scan, there should be an idiot display somewhere on the main board that would tell her what she needed to know, in several languages and nonverbal symbols. Since the controls worked at all, she ought to be able to bring up station scan. The rocker switch, when she found it, was located underneath a fold-out panel. Brunn pushed it with a silent prayer for luck, and the displays came up, flickering badly at first, but steadying.
How long have they been off? And what's powering them now?
She looked for the idiot display.
There.
As she'd expected, one of the languages on the display was her own. She flicked through the opening menu. Station layout, environmental system controls, life support, emergency procedures, which included a section on biohazard containment, power system, communications. Station layout made clear what this place had been, a biological laboratory of some kind.
Many colonies have them, But why then is this one derelict?
The station had been clearly divided into living space for the workers and 8 labs separated by locks and seals, 3 on one arm and 5 on the other. The big open gap was, Brun saw, out near the end of one arm. They had docked under a solar collecting panel halfway down the other. Deep in the station's core, the systems expert slept, as it had slept for decades of local time. When the lights came on, a trickle of power ran through its connections, shunted there by the designers who intended the expert to be functioning whenever the station was occupied. Slowly, slowly for its design, the expert woke, layer by layer. Power in the lines meant someone had returned. That gave permission for it to draw power on its own and engage the self-check and self-repair routines. The topmost instruction set began executing, inhibiting return of some active functions. Those who inhabited the station now might be either legitimate employees or intruders. If they were intruders, the expert was not to reveal itself by independent action, but instead isolate them and transmit a call for help. Passive scan devices collected information. 2 humans, female by all parameters, wearing female design employee pea suits whose code numbers were in the directory. Emergency evacuation suits from Laboratory 2. The expert engaged suit telemetry cautiously. The suit's inhabitants didn't notice. Neither human fit a known profile, but a quick check of the decay data from the reactor indicated that it had been decades since the expert was put to sleep. Therefore, it was unlikely that these employees would be known to it. One, in the control room, was following a rational restart procedure on station control functions. The expert did not interfere, but observed. She seemed to know what she was doing. The other was exploring the corridor leading to the second arm. The expert turned its attention to the outside world. Hazel came back to the control room.
Lights are on all down that corridor. I couldn't see into all the compartments, though. The ones I could, some were dark and some weren't. You must have hit a main switch.
Brun nodded and pointed to the panel that controlled lighting. It indicated power to the lights throughout, with a summary of lights switched off and lights not functioning even though switched on. She pointed at other panels. Hazel leaned closer. She had found the power reports for both the internal reactor, now nearly depleted and producing less than 40% of its former power, and the solar panels, also below nominal. With the damage they'd seen on the outside, she could believe that. Still, the station had been designed to support research and manufacturing. The power still available would easily restore life support throughout if they could find the air for it. The air for the central core she had already found. The heat generated by the reactor had nurtured the base beds of the environmental system all these years, and the slowly accumulating air had been stored under pressure. External air would free them from the need to carry tanks around and extend the effective life of the ones they had. Yet airing up the station would prove someone was aboard. It would be easily detectable from the outside. Moreover, if intruders blew the station and they didn't have their suits on, they'd die. Brun was still mulling this over when Hazel brought her a hand comp with voice output. Brun grinned and grabbed it. It had the standard plug connections, so Brun jacked it into the suit intercom connection on the outside and tapped some of the preset message keys. She had a choice of 3 languages and 20 preset messages.
All correct.
Brun looked at Hazel and cocked her head.
I didn't hear it. Maybe you have to hit the transmit key inside the helmet to transmit to other suits.
Brun fumbled with the comp and bumped the helmet transmit button with her chin as she keyed the preset message.
All correct.
Got it. Now maybe we can find one with more capability.
All correct.
Brun tapped each key once to be sure what the messages were.
Help. Danger. Shift report.
One of the keys transmitted no voice signal, but an electronic bleep that was probably, Brun thought, some kind of ID code for a central computer. She hit that one only once. Besides the preset messages, the hand comp had key input for other data.
Does this work?
But Hazel shook her head.